Well, farmers will tell you there's no such thing as a silver lining. There are hurdles that have to be dealt with. Though sometimes the solutions turn out to be opportunities. Olympia Yaga always wanted to be a farmer, but life threw her more than her share of challenges, some of them heartbreaking. When she finally got her farm in Canberra, she struggled to find a cost-effective, environmentally sustainable way to feed her stock. So she came up with a solution that turns out to be an opportunity to feed animals, to feed us, and also to reshape waste management. Olympia Yaga is a maggot farmer, and she's the CEO and founder of GoTerra. She joins me now. Hi, Olympia.
Hi, Jesse. How are you today?
Good. Really lovely to have you on the show. First day back for me. I didn't sort of expect we'd be talking maggots, but there you go.
You've got to come out with a bang, you see.
Yeah. What's the allure of farming for you? I know it's always been in your blood.
There's something about farming that's like all of the good stuff in one. So you're nurturing, you're producing, you're growing, and you're innovating all at the same time. And I love that it's always a challenge. You sort of never really predictably know what's happening, and that can be both heartbreaking and fun. But there's just something about finding balance and harmony with animals and plants that feels good to me.
Yeah, there'll be lots of farmers listening who know exactly what you're talking about. And we'll go back in a bit and talk about the long road you took to get there. But what happened when you finally did get your farm after 14 years in America? Again, I think farmers will relate to this. How different was the idea of making a living on a farm and the reality?
It's 100 million times different. And not so much that I didn't understand what it was going to take work wise, but just the complexity of finance in agribusiness now is such that without equity, you just can't even get into the market. And so we were looking at options to do small farming, so small acre holding with like a market garden or free range chickens. And even then the cost of production was 70% of feed. And feed is a commodity that's a volatile price. So you could be having good price or bad price. And as a small holder, you can't really buffer for those things because you're buying smaller lots, you're producing smaller lots. And so just really trying to figure out a way to get this to work without it impacting, like this idea that you have to work off farm to have a farm, like just didn't make sense because you're already working enough. You shouldn't work somewhere else to have a farm. And so, I was just like, there's got to be a way to fix this balance sheet problem.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about turning an uncontrollable into a controllable. Was there an aha moment when you thought, hey, maggots might be the answer?
Well, there's been a few of those in succession. But the first one was the idea that if we have food waste and it's in multiple supply and you have an insect that is a high protein source that will eat that waste, then you somehow now you've created new protein to market without tapping existing supply chains or resources. And if you could do that, then regionally you would create price security because you wouldn't have to be finding, you're not going to find it challenged, all the time by market forces. And then the second revolution of that was when I realized that not all waste is created equal and it's not all in a big pile conveniently waiting for me to scoop it up. And so that's when we designed the autonomous system to put the maggots as close to the waste as we could.
You're talking about the maggot robot.
Yeah.
Can you describe that for us?
It sounds so cool, but it's really very, very boring. It's an autonomous robotic system that's housed inside a shipping container, and it moves the insects from their place in the racks to feed and then back again. And it keeps those insects happy and healthy whilst they're in there eating. And we connect it to a receival system which accepts the waste, manages the waste, treats the waste, and then feeds the waste into the insect. So we had to solve for lots of trays in a small space, and what that means to climate. And then we also had to solve for the nature of plumbing and people putting not ideal things into pipes. So chopsticks aren't biodegradable and are not compostable and definitely plog up pipes. And so we had to learn all these things about food waste to get that to work.
So can you describe for us then the system in its entirety? What waste are we talking about, and what does it end up as, and where do you fit in as the farmer?
So we manage food waste at GoTerra, and we do and can do effluence and animal like mortalities. Mm. And basically we move that waste into a treatment system. So if it's on site at the source of creation, it goes from a bin lifter into a maceration, down into an auger that keeps it stirred, and then it's heat treated and fermented and put into, and then fed, pumped into the insects. At the main plant in Canberra, we have 5 units functioning off a central system. And so you have a big main dumping bay where we dump waste from trucks, and then that waste is moved onto a conveyor belt and put through a depackager and then pumped into a tank, and then the tank feeds the insects. So the purpose of what we've created is to create this utilitarian ability to support our customers where they are. So when they have a high volume of waste, we can go take the unit to them, and when they need their waste to be aggregated with other people to make managing it more affordable, we can centralize that system. And so it just means that we can do a little bit more and make a lot more maggots, which is very exciting.
And there will be people listening thinking, but maggots don't stay maggots forever.
No, and soy doesn't stay ideal for harvesting forever either. There's a time, as with any product, to harvest, and an age where the harvest is ideal. For us, we put the insects in at 5 days and we pull them out at 12 days later, so at 17th day of their life, which is about the time that they're starting to think, I've eaten enough, it's time for me to turn to a fly. And subsequently, it's the time that they stop eating. So we want to stop the consumption right at the peak of their consumption. And then that way we get the optimized waste management. And then we remove the insects and separate them from their manure. And so now we have 2 products, manure of insects, which is the frass, and the maggot themselves, which is a protein. And we can do whatever we like with them. They're very, very universal products that can go into a lot of different things.
For example?
Well, let me tell you. So it's like the one of those late night shows where they're like, but wait, there's more. So the manure is manure. And so it's very exciting because it's really high in nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So the NPK of insect manure, depending on what they've eaten, can range between 3 to 4. Ours is generally 4 to 1 on NPK, so really high in nitrogen, which is a great thing for Australian farmers, certainly, but more, you know, farmers across the world. The insect themselves are high in melanin, chitin, lauryleic acid, and the oil is a direct comparable to palm oil. And so even just with those random names that we've probably heard, we all know that there's use cases for all of these subparts. So yes, we can turn the insects into livestock feed because the protein, they're really high in protein. So live, our insects are 46% protein and 37% oil, fat. When we separate them into the parts, then we have a really high protein product. So upwards of 56 to 60%, we get a pure oil product that, like I said, is really high in beneficial omega-3s and 6s, but then also has this palm oil quality, so we can use it to make soap, degreaser, cosmetics, a whole bunch of things. And then the melanin is able to be used in a wide variety of electronics, primarily semiconductors. And then chitin can be used to make plastic.
Wow.
So I know, isn't it the coolest thing? All in a tiny little maggot that's just, for so many years as a sheep farmer, we've just spent a lot of time trying to kill. So, it's an exciting opportunity now when you imagine, you know, if you imagine any of our conventional industries back in the day, so we milked and we made milk and cheese, and now we make milk and we make all these other milk products, right? And same with wool. First, we just made jumpers and army blankets, and now we're making bras and underwear, and we can valorize these products much better. As supply chains have built, I just think there's something really exciting about a product that can be split into so many valuable things that can be grown without water, without arable land, and on a waste stream that is in need of management. It's an exciting time to be a farmer, I think.
And how much of a marketing challenge is the ick factor?
Well, from my end, I have not a lot. Because
I can imagine.
Time for farmers don't, and producers as a whole aren't really put off by these things. They're intrigued by them. They're excited by them. That, as I said, most farmers spend a lot of time trying to find a harmony with the rhythm of the land. And so they understand the circular nature of things, and it makes sense. And let's be real, farmers tend to not be picky as long as the nutrients are right. Right. So, give me a protein that meets my spec, thank you very much. Right. And if the price is right, that's great. I think where the insect industry does find challenges is when we want to put insects into human consumption.
Yeah.
And then we do bump up against sort of our very privileged European background where, you know, insects are gross. And that was a survival mechanism, right, in the past. Like, don't eat anything with insects on it. It might have disease. We have fridges now. We're fine. We can we can eat food that, you know, is a bit different. So I think there's a bit of work still to be done in getting things across the line. But I think if we look at how our food system is evolving, like how fast the vegan movement and the no meat movement has propelled in the last even 5 years, I think what we're seeing is that the social will of our communities is leaning towards doing better for the planet. Yeah. And so we're going to make choices based on that first. And so we won't care as much that they're icky, because we'll care more that they do good in the world.
I'm talking to Olympia Yaga, maggot farmer and CEO and founder of GoTerra. And this topic alone would be enough for 20 minutes. But your own story too, Olympia, is really compelling. And you have spent a life really working around challenges. The first one, I don't know, perhaps not everyone would think this was a challenge, but for you, was it a challenge to be pregnant when you left school and to keep the dream of working on a farm alive?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I don't know, like, nobody should be pregnant at 18 or have, you know, be participating in a pregnancy of an 18-year-old. And I think we're not well equipped to make great decisions at that time. And I feel fortunate that whatever it was in that 18-year-old me that kept me in school and kept me going, even though it was hard, I'm grateful for, because it would have been a lot easier just to stop. I think you aren't ready for what it takes to work and have children. And at a time where I should be just accepting jobs all over the place and taking them as I find them, and, you know, doing Jillaroo-ing out up north or wherever, instead I was sort of having to figure it out around this sort of new difficult sort of part of my calendar, I guess. And that was hard. And then, of course, he died when he was 2.5, and so that made it even harder. So, yeah.
Yeah, and sorry, of course, I'm sorry to hear that and to share that with listeners as well, because it's a really tragic turn to your story. How does that change your perspective on what a challenge really is?
Yeah, I think that's why I share it, right? I think when it happened to me, the thing that brought me the most solace were other people who'd come through the other side of grief or hardship.
Yeah.
And whose story I could resonate with, but also inevitably we always think that somebody else's story is harder than our own. And there's some sort of there's almost a medicinal quality to that feeling where you're like, oh, if she can do it, I could, right? And what you don't realize is that your story is doing the same thing for them. And because we just naturally have more empathy for each other than we do for ourselves. And so,
that's so true.
I think what I did by making that part of my story unapologetically was like, I got to carry him with me, which was really important. But I also, it was just this sort of little delicate reminder all the time that, like, this should be fun. This should be exciting. We should be having a good time. And just to remember that, I think. Mm.
And you decided, perhaps understandably, to change scene. You left the outback. You went to the United States. And in case anyone thought you might take the easy path from there, you married an American Marine who was deployed to Iraq several times.
Yeah, look, I might be questioned on my choice-making matrix.
So suddenly you're part of a military family. And got to meet a few families going through something similar, sacrificing and coping.
Yeah. Yeah, it was not a fun time to be a US Marine wife, 2000 through to 2014. And that, you know, just a completely different world to an Australian. You know, we turn up on Anzac Day. Yay, we're very proud. That, like, the sum total of diffidence we pay to our military, and personally, rightly so. I think they are people. We shouldn't, creating myths around our veterans actually helps create problems for veterans. Mm. But I wasn't ready for how the US feels about its veterans, and you end up part of this tribe. You get discounts at restaurants. Everybody tells you thank you for your husband's service, which is really odd. Huh. Your friends keep dying overseas. That's weird. And you spend literally a large portion of your life scared that this person that you married and you like a lot is going to die. And it feels like you're living in a really bad Hallmark movie, like just a bad one. Where it like never gets happy and you're just like,
yeah.
When's the kid start?
There's really some stuff that spouses and caregivers of military go through that is unique, right? This kind of the tragedy, but also you noticed the resentment, and I'm sure some guilt about the resentment too.
Oh God! Like, and it'll eat you alive, because you end up, you've like followed this person who was super charismatic, and you fell all in love with them and their slick haircut, and then you end up dumped in this town of strip malls, Baptist churches and laundrettes, and there's no jobs, like literally no work. And then you've got no friends. There are people everywhere, but finding a group of friends is really difficult because everyone either feels cut from the same cloth or they're like so disenfranchised that it's just angry all the time. And so finding a place to have normal life interaction just almost becomes impossible because everything about your life is completely clouded by this operational tempo, the kinetic nature of their deployments. You know, we would all cancel appointments like early in the on when they'd go away, and we'd all have a meeting to go out for dinner, and then we get the phone call. They might be coming home today.
Yeah.
And we would just stop our plans and just stop everything. And then you'd go home and you'd wax and shave and clean the kids and do all the stuff. And then they wouldn't come. And then you're like, oh, I could have been out with my friends. But the next day the phone call will come again and you'll ditch everything and stand there one more time. And it's nobody's fault. It's just the way that it works. But if you don't realize what's happening to you, after a while you keep playing the game, but you just get angrier and angrier and angrier. So it's a really 50% divorce rate in the US Marine Corps, 65% I think it is in US Marine Special Forces. So it's not a safe place for a marriage to be.
There was one good thing that came out of your husband's deployments, Snickle Fritz.
I know. How good is she? Yeah. So So he had been, he's got, he went to the US. Oh, he went to the US. He went to Iraq 4 times and Afghanistan 2 times. And he was, at all times, he was combat units. And so the second to last deployment, he was like, I found this dog. She's really cool. Whatever. And he was just trying to be all nonchalant. And I'm like, do we really don't care about the dog like at all? And he's like, eh. Anyway, and then I started seeing her photo everywhere in all the other team photos. And I'm like, this dog is not a normal dog. Like, this is different. There's a puppy rescue mission, which is a charity organization that used to raise money to bring these dogs back from Afghanistan.
Wow.
And so they raised the money in like 2 days. On Facebook, I think it was. And yeah, he had to bribe a taxi driver to drive her to Kabul. And then the taxi driver had to take her and put her on a plane, which is like, that was dicey. Like, who says he would do it? Like, he might have just dropped her off somewhere. And then she flew to Qatar and then from Qatar to the US. And we picked her up in Washington, DC. And never been trained, like, has been. She was treated like a queen over in the barracks. And so, she made a mess inside. Someone just cleaned up after her. They never bothered trying to teach her anything. And she moved into the house and she's hasn't chewed a shoe or done anything, never made a mistake inside. She's like the most human dog on the planet. But she saved us as a family and gave me and the children somebody or something to focus on while he was gone on that last deployment. She's been a godsend.
Is she
She's really funny.
still around?
Yeah, she's 9 now. She's the
Oh,
same
boy.
age as our daughter. And she lives on a farm in Cooma, New South Wales. And she spends most nights outside playing with foxes, which is really funny. So she won't let them eat anything, but she also does not chase them. She just like plays with them. So yeah, you can hear them crying and at night, and she'll scratch to go outside. She's gone to hang out with her red friends. Yeah. It's quite funny.
So how big is this maggot robot thing going to get?
Oh, we're going world, Jesse. We're going to do it. We're
Awesome.
taking it. Yeah, we're going to. I think it's really an interesting time as a startup. We knew we were onto something in the beginning, and we pushed and we raised our first round and got the first prototype, and those sorts of things are all very normal. But now, the plant in Canberra is operating and growing. We've got a staff that can solve pretty much any problem. Like you can, a while ago, if I wasn't there, the place would fall over. But now I can not be there, and they are just, I have this team, it just can move mountains, and the tech works. And that sounds like a really mundane, surprising thing to say, but it is the hardest part of deep tech innovation is to get tech that's ready to commercialize. And we did that. And so now it's time to just execute the crap out of this thing and scale it and grow, because we have 8 years left in a decisive decade to do something meaningful, to redirect our supply chains, recreate our food system, create sovereignty and security for our regions. And I think this is one of those ways we can do that. So we're going to go as hard as we can.
It's a pleasure and an inspiration to spend some time talking to you. Thank you very much, Olympia Yaga, maggot farmer and the CEO and founder of GoTerra, which, by the way, is a portmanteau of maggot and Canberra. It's been great to chat to you. Good luck and thanks so much.
Thanks, Jesse. It's been wonderful.